listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This past week saw the 10th annual summit of the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as they gathered in Johannesburg. On Thursday, Brazil's President Michel Temer, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, China's President Xi Jinping, and South Africa's President Matamela Cyril Ramaphosa addressed the assembled dignitaries, looking forward to the BRICS second decade. This was South Africa's President Ramaphosa as he introduced the other heads of state.
Thank you. Let us get started. Your Excellency President Temer, Your Excellency President Putin, Your Excellency Prime Minister Modi, Your Excellency President Xi, honorable ministers from various countries of BRICS, distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have all of you gathered here. From its formation, the BRICS partnership has had its sight firmly set on the future. It is itself the product of a rapidly changing world, which has seen the emergence of new economies, the realignment of old alliances, and shifts in the balance of global power. It is therefore appropriate that at this moment in the evolution of BRICS, we should focus on collaboration for inclusive growth and shared prosperity in the fourth industrial revolution. Quantum leaps in technology and innovation present enormous opportunities for growth, for development, and indeed for human progress. This surge in innovation has the potential to dramatically improve the productivity and to place entire countries on a new trajectory of growth and prosperity. It has the potential to solve many of the social problems we face by better equipping us to combat disease, hunger, and environmental degradation. However, unless it is approached in a collaborative manner, underpinned by a developmental agenda, rapid technological change could merely serve to entrench existing disparities within and between countries. It could also create new fault lines in our society. This places, therefore, a huge and great responsibility on all of us. Through our collective effort, by working together, I'm certain that we will be able to confront the challenges and seize the opportunities that this new age of development also presents us. We proceed from the understanding that this is not simply a digital revolution, but a fundamental shift in the way that people live, in the way they work, and in the way that they relate to each other. It is a phenomenon that cuts across all industries and all technologies. There is no area of economic activity that is immune and untouched by technological disruption. According to Professor Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, the fourth industrial revolution is characterized by a fusion of technologies that is blurring the lines between the physical, digital, and biological spheres. This means, therefore, that our response needs to be comprehensive and integrated. As BRICS countries, we should not become mere adopters or observers of new technologies. Rather, we need to combine our resources and expertise to become innovators and creators. We should not allow technology to shape our societies. We must instead ensure that the needs of our societies shape the technologies that we develop in our various countries. We must ensure that mastery of the fourth industrial revolution does not become the exclusive preserve of just a handful of countries. We must promote inclusivity, diversity, and cooperation. Excellencies, the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution provide developing and emerging economies with the opportunity to leapfrog the technologies of the preceding revolutions. The rapid adoption of mobile telecommunications in Africa and other parts of the developing world, for example, demonstrates how innovation can ignite sudden bursts of development. It demonstrates that, properly harnessed, new technologies can ensure more efficient processes and more reliable systems of service delivery. They can expand economic participation by ensuring that knowledge and information is more broadly disseminated across the population. To succeed, however, we need to equip our people with the necessary skills to thrive in such a society and in such an economy. The World Economic Forum predicts that the three most important skills for an employee or a worker by 2020 will be complex solving problems critical thinking, and creativity. Without adequate training, only a few emerging countries will possess these skills in sufficient numbers, while others will see their prospects stifled by automation. There is a new need to develop more agile and applied education models. Whilst this must start even before a child enters school and continue right through to our universities and colleges, there is an urgent need in developing and emerging economies to reskill a significant portion of the current workforce. Governments should formulate and institute policies that are supportive of these processes. Such policies should provide a favorable environment for foreign investment. Such investment improves the supply of relevant skills and expands capacity for research. Equally important are policies that support and stimulate local industries. It is against this backdrop that BRICS ministers of industry resolved to establish the BRICS Partnership on the New Industrial Revolution. It aims to translate the vision of the second decade of BRICS cooperation into a reality through deepened cooperation. Under the partnership and in support of the manufacturing sector, a new industrial revolution advisory group comprised of policymakers and experts from all BRICS countries will be established. As the BRICS Forum, we can neither ignore nor take for granted the realities of the fourth industrial revolution. As we enter the second golden decade of BRICS, we need to look to the future and place ourselves at the forefront of the extraordinary changes that are taking place. In conclusion, our officials must engage in robust discussions to develop concrete and effective actions. As a bloc, we should use this opportunity to ensure that we fully appreciate and exploit the opportunities presented by this wondrous new age of technology in building a brighter shared future for humanity. I thank you all, and I'm now going to invite His Excellency President Xi Jinping to deliver his statement. Thank you.
Your Excellency President Cyril Ramaphosa, Your Excellency President Michel Temer, Your Excellency President Vladimir Putin, Your Excellency Prime Minister Narendra Modi, let me begin by thanking President Ramaphosa and the South African government again for your warm hospitality and thoughtful arrangements. The BRICS summit is convened in Africa again after a lapse of 5 years. This is an occasion to celebrate. The theme of this summit, BRICS in Africa, collaborating for inclusive growth and shared prosperity in the fourth industrial revolution, is most fitting under the current circumstances. The previous three industrial revolutions, the rise of mechanization in the 18th century, the harnessing of electricity in the 19th century, and the advent of the information age in the 20th century, were all characterized by transformative advancements in science and technology. Such breakthroughs have greatly unleashed social productivity and significantly improved people's living standards and profoundly shaping the course of human history. Today, we are experiencing another revolution in science, technology, and industry, only greater in scope and depth. Breakthroughs are being made in quick succession in frontier technologies like big data and artificial intelligence. New technologies, new business models, and new industries are emerging one after another. Countries around the world have found their interests and future tied together like never before. That said, we have yet to sustain global growth with new driving forces and to address the North-South imbalance. What is more, constant flare-ups of geopolitical conflict and the escalation of protectionism and unilateralism are directly affecting the external development environment of emerging markets and developing countries. History keeps surging forward, independent of people's wish. We BRICS countries must therefore have a keen grasp of the trend of our times, deepen our strategic partnership, and consolidate our cooperation framework underpinned by economic, political, and security cooperation and people-to-people exchanges. This way, we will turn our vision of the second golden decade into a reality and build a community with a shared future for mankind. First, we must unlock the enormous potential for our economic cooperation. Closer economic cooperation for shared prosperity is the original purpose and priority of BRICS cooperation. It is also in the economic field that we enjoy the most promising, diverse, and fruitful cooperation. We need to step up trade, investment, economic, financial, and connectivity cooperation to make this pie still bigger. At the same time, we must work together at the United Nations, the Group of 20, and the World Trade Organization to safeguard the rule-based multilateral trading regime, promote trade and investment liberalization and facilitation, and reject protectionism outright. It is important that we continue to pursue innovation-driven development and build a partnership on new industrial relations to strengthen coordination on macroeconomic policies, find more complementarities in our development strategies, and reinforce each other's efforts in renewing economic driving forces and upgrading economic structure. In this context, China will host 17 human resources development programs. Experts from our five countries will be invited to draw up a blueprint for cooperation in the new industrial revolution. We'll host 10 human resources development programs.
Second, we must safeguard global peace and security.
Political and security cooperation is an important component of BRICS strategic partnership. We should stay committed to multilateralism and to the purposes and principles of the UN Charter. We should call on all parties to abide by international law and basic norms governing international relations, and to settle disputes through dialogue and differences through consultation. By fully leveraging the role of BRICS meetings of foreign ministers, national security advisors, and permanent representatives to the United Nations, we can make our voice heard, put forward our solutions, and jointly work for a new type of international relations featuring mutual respect, equality, justice, and win-win cooperation. Third, we must expand people-to-people exchanges. We, the BRICS countries, boast great civilizations. When it comes to cultural and people-to-people exchanges, there is a lot we can do together. Such exchanges have notably gained momentum over the last year or two.
We should aim at greater people-to-people connectivity and more popular support for BRICS cooperation through extensive exchanges in cultural, educational, health, sports, tourism, and other areas.
在去年的, 啊, 这个厦门会晤,
During the Xiamen Summit last year,
这个已经举行了一些
We held a series of programs for people-to-people exchange, for example, the film exhibition by five countries, including the one where the time has gone. And we also organized other sport exhibitions. Just now, at our close session, President Putin put forward an initiative which has been responded warmly by all the parties. That is, starting now and aiming at the next decade, we need to have more and more robust people-to-people exchanges and institutionalized such exchanges. We also propose joint touring exhibitions by the BRICS alliances of museums, art museums, national galleries and libraries, and closer cooperation in cultural, creative and tourism industries and at the subnational level. We can spread the story far and wide to further enhance the mutual understanding and the traditional friendship among our people. Fourth, we must build a network of closer partnerships. Since the inception of the BRICS mechanism, openness and inclusiveness have remained our abiding commitment. The BRICS Plus approach we adopted at the Xiamen Summit is designed to strengthen the unity and coordination among BRICS members for greater cohesion and at the same time to keep broadening the BRICS circle of friends in a joint pursuit of shared development and prosperity for all emerging markets and developing countries. We may explore BRICS Plus cooperation within the United Nations, the G20, and other frameworks to advance the common interests and boost the development space for emerging markets and developing countries, contributing more to world peace and development through broader partnerships.
各位同事,
colleagues, the future of BRICS is in the hands of our people. Let us work together with the rest of the international community for an open, inclusive, clean, and beautiful world with lasting peace, universal security, and common prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you, President Xi Jinping. It's now my honor and pleasure to ask President Putin to make his statement.
Thank you, Mr. President Ramaphosa, dear friends, President Xi Jinping, President Temer, Prime Minister Modi,
уважаемые коллеги, совсем недавно, вот только
recently,
что, в узком составе мы отмечали,
in a close meeting with Noted, and I'd like to start my
вспомнить об этом, что в эти дни мы совместно отмечаем столетие выдающегося государственного деятеля Южной Африки,
centennial anniversary of the outstanding statesman of the South African Nelson Mandela. During his entire life, he has been upholding and protecting the principles of equality, openness and I think that we have full right to state that Mr. Mandela's legacy is reflected in the activities of BRICS. These principles are the basis of the cooperation between the BRICS member states, and it has the character of the real strategic partnership.
BRICS membership
reacting jointly to the threats and challenges of our peace and stability. We are cooperating in fighting terrorism, extremism, drug trafficking, transborder organized crime. And BRICS has a unique play in the global economy. This is the largest market in the world. And the joint GDP is 42% of the global GDP and keeps growing. The 22.3 3%. And economic sphere, the BRICS countries are collectively solving problems related to modernization of the industry, development of modern technologies, high technologies, development of our competitive edge, and improvement of the life of our population. Those are the priorities of the South African chairmanship in the BRICS. And these priorities, the BRICS member states took into account in their work during this year, and this work has been successful. Here we are talking about the theme which has been proposed for a discussion at this meeting, the fourth industrial revolution, or the so-called digital revolution. Affects the development of all countries of the world and including BRICS member countries. The digitalization process covers almost all spheres of our life. It creates new economic centers, reduces costs, and increases the productiveness and efficiency of labor. Our task is to create comfortable environment in order to attract investments into the state-of-the-art economic sectors to stimulate the creation of new technologies and their introduction into the economy. The digitalization is one of the priorities of the economic policy of my country, Russia. We've adopted a national technological initiative. It's a set of measures to guarantee the technological development of Russia till 2035. We've launched the Digital Economy of Russia program. We expect that this program will allow us to increase the labor productivity by 2024 by 30%, and new sectors of Russian economy will generate 10%, more than 10% of Russian GDP. In the environment of digital realities, it's very important to guarantee the safety and security of business and our citizens. We take necessary measures, legislative and other measures in order to achieve the situation when the creation of safe and reliable internet environment go hand in hand with due guarantee of protection of personal data and private life in digital sphere. We hope that closer partnership of BRICS countries in the area of digital economy will allow us to get better qualitative and quantitative indicators of our cooperation. For Russia, consolidation of our trade and investment links with BRICS partners is of high priority. In 2017, the trade with our BRICS countries has grown 30%, which was more than $102 billion of dollars. And we are aiming at further developing this kind of partnership. We pay special attention to the direct contacts between our businessmen. I support new initiatives of Business Council of BRICS in the area of e-commerce, SMEs, and proposals to simplify administrative barriers in order to stimulate trade between our countries. We evaluate positively the activities of the Council for implementation of joint multilateral projects. This should go hand in hand with the activities of New Development Bank. Business should be involved in filling up credit portfolio of the bank. Recently, the operative activities of the New Development Bank have expanded notably. Board of Directors of the bank has approved 21 projects, and out of this number, 5 projects will be implemented in Russia with the budget of $5 billion. We support the support creation of regional branches of the bank. The negotiations are going now with Brazil. We hope that when these negotiations are over, we start to analyze the possibility to open national office in Russia. We evaluate positively the contingent creation, the contingent reserves arrangement, which is a very important tool for operative financing of our banking sector, for collecting and processing statistical data of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. In 2017, in Semin, the decision has been taken by us to create bond fund of national currencies of BRICS. It's very important for the development of financial and currency systems of our countries. At practical launch of this fund in 2019 corresponds to the BRICS interests. We are grateful to our BRICS partners for the support of Russian idea to create BRICS Energy Research Center. I'm sure that from the quality point of view of its reviews and forecasts, it will be able to compete as equals, as equal with leading world energy analytical agencies. I'd like to attract the attention to the Russian bid to organize World Expo 2025 in Yekaterinburg City. We do not compete here with cities from Brazil, India, China, or South Africa. Dear friends, we really count on your support. And at the end of my presentation, I'd like to thank our South African friends, the President of South Africa, Mr. Ramaphosa, for enormous contribution into practical interaction in the framework of BRICS. And thank you for paying attention to our idea to expand our cooperation in the humanitarian sectors, sport, cinema, etc. Thank you for your attention.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Is democratic socialism the future of the Democratic Party, the future of America? Is moving to the left a winning strategy to take on Donald Trump's vision of conservative populism? One thing is undeniable. Mainstream politics in both parties are under pressure to evolve and become more accountable. Crosstalking Democratic Socialism, I'm joined by my guest, Steve Maltzberg in New York. He's a conservative political commentator. In Washington, we have Ivan Elin. He is a senior fellow at the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. And in Los Angeles, we cross to Ron Placone. He is a comedian. He's a frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I always go to the person that got up earliest for the program, so that means it's you, Ron, in Los Angeles. God bless your soul.
thanks, Peter.
We hear a lot about the rise of democratic socialism, the turn to the left in the party, though the donors don't seem to want to go there. What is democratic socialism? Because I'd like to remind our viewers, I lived in communist Eastern Europe, and they called that democratic socialism, okay? And they didn't have a lot of Birkenstocks, and they didn't have a lot of cappuccinos, I'd like to point out. So, Ron, what is it in a nutshell? Go ahead.
Well, democratic socialism in the contemporary American sense. I mean, you know, whenever people throw around these terms, you need to factor in, you know, the snapshot in contemporary time. But democratic socialism is certainly not authoritarian socialism or anything like that. Democratic socialism, as the DSA is presenting it, basically just gives more rights to the workers. It still allows enterprise and stuff like that. However, workers have more rights and they have more of a say and they see more of the product. And what the DSA's mission is in particular is to try to get away from the economy that instead exploits workers and is focused on destroying the environment and war. They're trying to get away from all that to an economy that is more sustainable, that workers have a better seat at the table, and where everybody has health care.
Okay, Steve, I mean, socialism tends to become authoritarian if you don't keep an eye on it. I'd like to point out, and I'm living in a country that had a pretty disastrous experience with it. But Steve, you know, when I listen to a lot of people talking about democratic socialism, Ron pointed out workers' rights. I don't hear that so often when they talk. I hear about abolishing ICE, having open borders, cultural relativism. That's what I hear. I hear identity politics, and that makes the hair on the back of my head stand up. Go ahead.
Absolutely. All you have to do is go to the Democratic Socialists of America website and find out what the Democratic Socialists of America are really all about. Everything you just alluded to, plus guaranteed income, whether or not you're working, when you talk about the workers having more rights, they want the end of capitalism and workers to run the show. Workers would own and run everything. There wouldn't be private ownership by corporations. Stockholders would go to you know where. And let me just, if I may, I hate reading things, but this is very important. The disgraceful use of prisons to regulate behavior would be replaced with a system that decriminalizes a wide range of offenses and provides victims. Victims are the ones in prison. Provides victims with mental health care and various forms of counseling to help people find productive ways to move forward after committing serious crimes. So you commit a serious crime, no more prison, you'll get counseling. These people are loony bins.
Okay.
Please let the Democrats run on this, please.
Okay, Steve, what you just described was Gitmo in one form or another. Let me go to Ivan Elon in Washington here. I hate reading things too, but I will. A Harvard University published a study in April that found 51% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 dislike capitalism, with a majority preferring socialism as a political system. Is socialism a political system? That's what I'm worried about. When Ron talks about workers, I'm all ears. I'll listen to workers' rights. I don't have a problem with that, okay? We need a healthy left in the United States here. But people are talking about a political system that is socialism. Go ahead, Ivan.
Well, of course, the technical definition of socialism is nationalizing industry, nationalizing the means of production. And, you know, I'm not sure I hear anybody really talking about that. I see striking similarities between the right and the left that we have now. I wouldn't consider Trump a conservative. I would consider him a nationalist. He's been for quite a big government. If we want to talk big government in all its forms, I think, you know, he was he passed and the Republicans went right along with him, $300 billion budget, meanwhile cutting taxes and yawning the deficit and the debt. We also have him putting on tariffs, protectionist tariffs, which isn't conservative, and then bailing out the farmers with $12 billion worth of aid, which doesn't really cover the it's not going to cover the losses that he's cut off with tariffs. He's also said he's not going to do away with Social Security and Medicare. Now, my purpose here isn't to attack Trump. I'm just saying that he's a more nationalist Republican. And I think Bernie Sanders' followers have a lot in common with him to some extent. Now, of course, that's left populism, and he's sort of a right populist in the case of the president. So you're seeing the encroachment of big government, and you know we have all these terms for democratic socialism, right-wing populism, but we may end up sort of all at the same place with more government encroachment on our freedoms.
You know, Ron, it seems to me that, you know, in looking at some of the races, it's still a more of a rejection of the status quo, and some people move to the right and some people move to the left. But everybody seems to have a problem except for people in the center, and they want to keep everything the way it is. And I did mention just off the cuff, donors don't want a big change here too. And I'm not just attacking the Democrats here. You could easily, as Ivan did, do it to the Republicans as well. Go ahead, Ron.
Absolutely. First of all, We have border security. We had border security before ICE existed. It's not like anybody who calls for the abolishment of ICE is calling for open borders. I'm in favor of abolishing ICE. I think this country is a lot like espresso in that regard, better without ICE. However, that doesn't mean open borders. That just means a rejection of this organization that is being authoritarian and brutal. So that's the first point. And also, the Democratic establishment is not a big fan of the DSA or anything they're about.
That's an understatement.
Because their first priority, their first priority is stopping progressive policies from happening and pleasing the donors. Their priority further down the list is maybe beating a Republican. But that's not that big of a deal, because whether that happens or not, the gravy train keeps a rolling. We are seeing a rise in populism. Now, I would make the argument, and I know some of you guys on this panel see things differently. That's fine. But I would say right-wing populism isn't really a thing. That's kind of an oxymoron. So I think Trump ran on this kind of idea of that, and a lot of people latched on to it. I would say largely he hasn't delivered on that, and I don't think he's going to. But I think that the time for true populism is at the forefront right now. And if history in the United States is any indication, we're kind of due for a sharp turn to the left right now. We're mirroring the Great Depression in many ways.
Okay, but
what happened after that was FDR.
Okay. Let me go to Steve here, because, I mean, again, and Ron, you've been on this program before, and we've discussed this, left and progressive and the establishment and all that. That's fine. But, Steve, ever since 2010, the Democrats, have lost over and over and over again, because they keep running on the same message over and over again. And one can make the argument that Trump appealed to the people that feel disaffected. I mean, a lot of white men, a lot of white people in general voted in 2016 because they finally found a candidate that they could see that would consider their concerns. OK, so, I mean, a lot has been said here, but I mean, I do think that this is a lot about insurgency, and it's all about Bernie Sanders. I think this is going to be the most important event remembered, not that Trump was elected, but what was done to Bernie. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, first of all, let's also point out that Donald Trump got a higher percentage of Hispanics voting for
Good
him
point.
Than did Mitt Romney or John McCain, which I think is something goes overlooked and really shouldn't. Look. The reason why the donors don't want the Socialist Democrats' influence and policies and platforms is because they can't win. I mean, that's why someone like me is begging you and begging the Democrats to run
How
on these programs. Let the public know where you stand.
Keep going, Steve.
Because she lives in a little cocoon. First of all, a very small percentage of people voted, and she happens to live in a district where the message appeals. But even she isn't honest when she is pressed on what she believes as a democratic socialist. She says, "Oh, I don't think we should have labels. I don't like labels." if the word got out that she was for abolishing prisons, abolishing capitalism,
she's not calling for for-profit prison industry. Those are two completely different things.
Oh, it's abolishing
those
prisons.
Those are two completely different things. And if you want to talk about what's going on in private prisons,
radical,
we could have a long conversation like that and how it's exploitative. Those are two
small,
completely different things.
Before the program,
I said one thing: equal time for everyone. Ivan, let me turn to you. The GOP should love these Democratic Socialists because it's dividing the Democratic Party, and you can tell from the very top they're scared of these people. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, I would say to the Democrats that, it's OK to have that wing of the party. I mean, the Republicans had the Tea Party wing, but it does make your candidates unelectable in certain places. Now, if the Democratic Party runs more conservative candidates in these places, they have a better chance of winning. But I'm sure the party apparatus doesn't really care for a lot of this talk about free college education for everybody, Medicare for all, because these are very expensive programs and nobody has figured out in the Democratic Party or anywhere else how to pay for these. But of course, the Republicans have done this with their tax cuts. That's what they do to get elected.
Okay.
Meanwhile, they never cut spending and fed. Instead, they increase it.
I have to jump in and we have to go to a hard break. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on democratic socialism. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Ron here. Again, I want to stress the issue of identity politics, because when I look at some of these things, I mean, Democratic Socialists of America, I mean, they've been around for a while, okay? And I looked at some of their older literature, and you're spot on. They looked at more at working people, getting a fair shake. That's fine. But what I see now is this infusion of identity politics, and I think that, you know, I can say pretty confidently, given election results over the last few years, that doesn't work. It doesn't work for the Democratic Party, but they don't, you know, when you talk about transgender toilets and stuff like that, it turns off the heartland. I'm from the heartland. This is something that people, they want the factories to start opening up again. They want their wages to go up. And then when you have these things, you know, this political correctness and these pronouns, all this nonsense, I don't have any patience for it because it doesn't advance my life or the people around me. How do you address that, Ron?
Well, there is a world of difference between exploiting identity politics for just political jargon nonsense and addressing issues affecting different communities. I would argue that the DSA is doing the latter. Who's doing the former? I would say that's what the Democratic establishment is doing. So I think a lot of the issues with identity politics, as in using it for wrong and dishonest means, I think that's something the Democratic establishment is doing. And there is, again, there's a world of difference between them and the DSA and movements like it. The Democratic establishment, they're the ones that like to point their fingers at people less powerful than them and say, oh, you didn't support Hillary Clinton. Well, clearly you're a sexist. You're not a big fan of Kamala Harris. Well, you're a sexist and a racist. That's where identity politics floats in a dishonest way. And there's a world of difference between that and addressing issues of different communities. One is a good thing, one, not so much.
Okay, well, Steve, but I mean, Ron just proved our point. I mean, this identity politics, it's a dragon that eats its own tail. So obviously, Trump supporters are sexist and homophobic, but within the Democratic Party, if you didn't support Hillary, then you're just as bad as the Trump people. I mean, this is insanity.
Right. It's Hillary will tell you, if you're a woman, you listen, you didn't vote for her. That's because you were listening to your boss and your husband and your boyfriend, and you're not strong enough to stick up for your own beliefs. You were told who to vote for. Don't forget, half the country's a basket full of deplorables, and that's the mainstream Democratic Party. Look, again, I can't say this enough. When you look at free this, free that. By the way, let's look to Latin American countries. Let's look to Venezuela. What's the inflation rate there? 40,000%. I mean, please, I beg the Democratic Party, adopt the leftist ideals here, adopt the platforms here, adopt the ideas here. You'll never win another election. Never. It's impossible in this country. And the fact that they don't see that really calls into question what their goal is, because they're not dumb. They're not stupid people. They know they can't win generalized elections. And the good point made by Ron earlier, the Democrats are running conservative Democrats who are anti-Pelosi and to a point pro-Trump on issues to win districts. And you're talking about nationalizing democratic socialism? It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, but
how do you explain Bernie Sanders then?
Go ahead, Ron. Go ahead.
How do you explain Bernie Sanders? And I mean, Peter, you even said yourself, Bernie Sanders is the biggest story here.
Yeah.
How do you guys, if you think that it can't win? And I mean, we don't disagree on the corruption of the Democratic establishment. That's one thing where all of us will be in agreement. But how do you explain Bernie Sanders, a guy who is an open socialist, who came out of nowhere and almost pretty much caused a grassroots revolution, probably would have had the establishment not cheated him, is applauded in the heartland with a true populist message? How do you explain Bernie Sanders if you entertain the thesis that democratic socialism can't win?
Steve, you want to reply?
Because Bernie Sanders is a polished socialist. He doesn't talk about any of the other issues. All he talks about is income inequality. It's unfair, unfair, unfair. He doesn't get into specifics. He doesn't talk about the jails. He doesn't talk about the groups that you're talking about, transgender, etc. He focuses on one message and one message only, which resonates with a certain percentage of the population, a rather large percentage perhaps. But when push comes to shove, if you want to run as a democratic socialist or a socialist, and you have to own the other policies that go with it, and that will never fly.
Okay, let me go to Ivan in Washington. I mean, is this a pivot, a transformational moment? Because, you know, in many ways, you could see that Trump is the same thing for the GOP, because a lot of the purists in the GOP still hate Trump, okay? And also what we have here in the Democratic Party, you know, there is a huge split. I mean, I think all of us would agree that income inequality is a big problem, and that it's the single most important issue that can divide a society. We can always have these other issues on the side. Income inequality is dangerous here. Ivan Elin, is the Democratic Party really being able to address that issue?
Well, I think we have to, I think both parties have noticed the income inequality. Even some conservatives have started talking about it. But the problem is that the parties differ on the cause. Of course, the cause to the Democrats or the Democratic Socialists are, big corporations and, excessive profits for corporations and not giving it back to the worker. For the conservatives, it's that the very opposite. It's that the system has become so bogged down with regulations and other things and big government that the market is not allowed to, all the regulations create essentially oligopolies and that sort of thing, and that causes income inequality. So it just depends on which side of the fence you're on politically.
Okay. Well, Ron, I mean, one of the things that was brought up to me here is that, this mantra, with it, free this, free education, free welfare, free education for everyone. And they still want to have an open borders. I want to harp on the open borders thing because, I mean, this has been amplified over the last few months here. I mean, if you want to have a big welfare state, a super welfare state, don't you think you should have a border to make sure the rest of the world doesn't take advantage of it? I mean, then people on the inside the border are going to say, whoa, we want this for ourselves because we're paying for it, okay? So the open borders argument kind of deflates unless you want cheap labor. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I mean, again, the abolishment of ICE and open borders are two different things. It's no one's calling for just complete nothing whatsoever. Everyone's calling for reasonable border security, at least to the extent that I see it. What people are against is the brutality of ICE. Secondly, it's not free stuff, quote unquote. What it is a reallocation of resources. We spend more on bombs in the military than pretty much the next 13 countries combined, just about. We have more than enough resources in this country to have a single-payer healthcare, nonprofit single-payer healthcare, which the community would pay for. It's not free stuff. It's a reallocation of resources of what we're already paying. We already pay a higher GDP for healthcare than most other countries, and we get less because of a broken for-profit system. Same with education. We could reallocate our resources to have tuition-free college in this country. We choose not to. Same with a Green New Deal or an infrastructure program. We have the resources to do all this stuff, but we don't allocate it that way. Instead, we just give bonus bomb money to the Trump administration or whoever's in power.
Okay.
Obama did the same stuff.
All right. Steve, education was mentioned, and that's another raw point for me. I think that all government expenditures, except for maybe preschool and kindergarten, should be cut because all they do is teach an ideology, this nonsense, post-Marxist, post-structuralism, and it brings up people that into the world that can't do anything except for yell and scream about a perceived victimhood, okay? I mean, I was in the University of California system for a long time, and they don't teach you much. They just teach you to be angry and teach you to be a victim. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, look at what Attorney General Sessions said the other day, talking about the universities calling some of them out by name, that, they're raising a bunch of snowflakes. They have safe rooms and quiet rooms and places you can run to and you can't offend people, perceived offenses and blah, blah, blah. The whole thing is becoming a total joke. Look, again, all this talk of free stuff, at least I think Ron acknowledged, it's not free. Everybody pays for it. And it is a reallocation of funds. I mean, so to say that ICE is brutal is insane. To say that without ICE, you're not advocating open borders is insane. The public is already, the polls show they're dead against getting rid of ICE.
So we didn't have border security before ICE?
I'd like to know what limitations.
There was no border security before ICE?
We live in a different world, and I'd like to know who you would keep out. I'd like to know who you would keep out under what circumstances. I dare you to name what the circumstances would be and who you would keep out. Look, the public is, again, I'm a one-note pony today because the public would never go for these radical leftist ideals, proposals, policies. So please, somehow, let your candidates run on these policies and you will suffer worse defeats than you did under Obama, whose candidates all throughout the country, state, local, government, every level, got slaughtered in the elections. You lost over 1,000 seats overall in the nation. So you want to make it 2,000? Adopt these policies.
Okay, Ivan. Mm-hmm. You mean
Obama, the guy who ran on a center-left platform and won twice, didn't deliver on it, by the way, but
Ronnie didn't have coattails. Okay, and that's undeniable. Okay, Ivan. You know what we've just
deliver on it
in a microcosm here. What we've seen on this program is not really a policy difference; it's a cultural difference, and I think that's what the election showed. Unfortunately, this cultural division. People are not talking to each other. We did a pretty good job on this program. Last 30 seconds go to you, Ivan Elin in Washington.
Well, I would just say, I think, you know, we need to stop the stereotypic yelling and talk about the issues. When we talk about all these expensive programs, the cut in the defense budget, the numbers just don't add up. I'm all for cutting the defense budget in half, but it's not going to pay for single-payer health care or free university education for everybody. We're $21 trillion in debt. We got $100 trillion in deficit. And I think both parties don't address those facts.
Okay, gentlemen, all I can say is to be continued. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.